Revelation chapter 7 we come to this evening after we've been on a bit of a break. The sixth chapter revealed to us the opening of the seals that were upon the scroll held in the right hand of the one who sat upon the throne. That, of course, was God the Father. And then you remember one came forth as though he were a lamb who had been slain. And he took the scroll because he alone was worthy to take the scroll and to loose the seals. And that, of course, was the Lion of the tribe of Judah who prevailed. And that is none other than Jesus Christ himself. And so that was recorded for us in the fifth chapter. Then we come to the opening of this seven-sealed scroll in the sixth chapter. And as we pointed out, this is the beginning of God's repossession of the earth. And before God repossesses the earth, he is going to judge the world and he's going to purge it from evil. And so that's what these seals are. They are judgments that are coming upon the world. And as we pointed out, there are seven seals, and then we move from seven seals to seven trumpets, and then from seven trumpets we move to the seven vials. And as I told you before, rather than seeing these in consecutive order, I think the better way to see them is in the sense that the six seals give us an overview, a big picture of the judgment that's coming. The seven trumpets give us an even more detailed picture of that judgment. And then the seals take us down to real specific aspects of that judgment. And so I think that's really the best way to understand this. Now, we saw how the Lord opened the first seal, and one came forth riding on a white horse, having a crown upon his head and a bow in his hands, and he went forth conquering to conquer. We saw that that was not Jesus Christ, because Jesus, of course, is the one who's holding the scroll and loosing the seal, but this is actually the beginning of the judgment that's yet to come upon the earth. This is the unleashing of the power of the devil. This is the Antichrist who is coming to power. And then following the Antichrist and going along with the various seals, we see with the second seal, there is a fiery red horse. And we see that war breaks out all around the world. And then we see that there's famine conditions under the third seal. And then under the fourth seal, we see that there's widespread death and destruction. And a fourth of the earth's population is killed under this particular seal. And then in the fifth seal, we have the cry of the martyrs, those who have been slain for the testimony of the Word of God. And then as we came to the sixth seal, we saw there these great cosmic disturbances where there was a great earthquake and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair and the moon became a sackcloth of hair and the moon became like blood and the stars of the heaven fell to the earth and so forth. And so all of this is describing this judgment that is going to come upon the world. And now, between the opening of the sixth and the seventh seal, there's a diversion that John takes us on, and he tells us about a special group of people. So verse 1, after these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, standing in the north, the south, the east, and the west. And they are holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea or on any tree. Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God, and he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel. The tribe of Judah, there were 12,000 sealed. Of the tribe of Reuben, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Gad, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Asher, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Simeon, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Levi, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Issachar, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Joseph, 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000 were sealed. Now, just who are these that are sealed? Well, the text is pretty clear. They are 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. The children of Israel are, in every single reference in the Bible, the natural descendants of Jacob. The children of Israel, that phrase is never used regarding anybody but the natural descendants of Jacob. It's never used allegorically. It's never used symbolically. It's only always exclusively a reference to the natural descendants of Jacob. These are 12,000 from each of the tribes of the children of Israel. These are 144,000 Jews who are going to be sealed by God at the beginning of the tribulation period. Now, this is where we see a shift in God's dealings with man. God, of course, in the beginning, dealt with man in a general sense, with the descendants of Adam, and then with the descendants of Noah. But then at a specific point in time, God set apart a man and his family, and from that man and his family came a nation, and God's dealings were primarily from that point on with that nation, the Jewish nation, the children of Israel. He made a special covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob and their descendants. And God's dealings were primarily, not exclusively, but primarily and covenantally, they were with the children of Israel from the time of Abraham to the time of Jesus Christ. And at the time of Christ, those very people to whom Jesus came as their promised Messiah, having rejected him, they were then rejected by God. The covenant was broken, and God discontinued his work among them nationally, and he began to work among the nations collectively once again to draw out from among the nations a people for himself. And that group is known biblically and historically as the church. Now, we are presently still in that age where God is drawing out from all the nations of the world, including Israel. He's drawing people out of every nation, from every tribe, from every tongue. He's drawing people out of the world into his family, into the body of Christ. But at the rapture of the church, everything shifts, and the emphasis is then no longer upon drawing out this people to become the bride of Christ, because that's been completed. Now God shifts his emphasis once again back to the nation of Israel, and he begins by sealing 144,000 of them from each of the 12 tribes. And so this is the beginning of God's restoration process for Israel. Now, 144,000, there are anywhere from 14 to 18 million Jews in the world today. So if you think of it in those terms, I mean, you think of 144,000, that sounds like a lot of people, and in one sense it is. But in comparison to the numbers of Jewish people in the world today, it is a relatively small number. And so here is going to be a remnant, and they will become God's instruments. They will become the ones who will witness to their fellow Jews. And as we follow through with the story, and as we put together some of the different Old Testament prophecies, they are going to be persecuted, and they are going to be harassed, and they are going to be, to a large degree, rejected by the vast majority of the nation. But they are going to have a special seal upon them that is going to protect them during this time of judgment that's coming upon the world. And those cataclysmic judgments that are coming upon the earth and bombarding all of those who are dwelling on the earth, this group will be supernaturally exempted from those judgments. That's what's being talked about here. So this is the beginning of the dispensation of the wrath of God and the restoration of Israel to its covenant relationship with the Lord. But this will not happen until the tribulation begins. Now, it's interesting that with the return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel, we, of course, now have a fairly substantial number of Jews living right in that land. And for this kind of a thing to be realized, I think it was necessary for them to be regathered back into the land. You see, because prior to their regathering back into the land, although they still maintained a distinct ethnic and religious identity, to a large degree, there was, because they were spread so far and wide, there's a lot of, there wasn't that cohesiveness. But now being back in the land, you can see where these things are going to begin to unfold. And you can see now that there will be some real clarity in regard to these things. Perhaps many of them will be those who inhabit the land of Israel. I don't know that that would be a requirement, but perhaps it would be. But as you look at this list, there is, interestingly, one tribe that's missing. And it is the tribe of Dan. Dan is not included here. And, of course, that brings the question, why? And we don't really know exactly why that is the case. Some have speculated that there was a judgment that still remains upon Dan, because Dan was the tribe that led Israel into idolatry in the very beginning. And that might very well be the case. Others have speculated that it is perhaps from the tribe of Dan that the false prophet would come. There's an interesting prophecy in Genesis 49 that speaks about, as Jacob is prophesying over his sons, he speaks of Dan as a serpent by the side of the road who strikes the horse in its heel so its rider falls backward. Now, quite frankly, I don't think anybody really knows exactly what that prophecy refers to, but it could possibly be a reference to the Antichrist, I guess. So nobody really knows why Dan is exempted, but they are not included in this list. But when you find the listing of the tribes mentioned in the kingdom age, Dan is then once again included. So here we have this picture of the sealing that's taking place and this divine protection that will be over these 144,000. Now, it's really important to take this at face value and to understand it literally. There have been those who have not done that. The Jehovah's Witnesses, they, in their early days, said that they were the 144,000. But then their organization grew beyond that number, so they had to come up with another theory. Even some biblical commentators, some evangelical commentators, have suggested that this isn't really a reference to a specific group of people. This is just sort of a general way of talking about the sealing that's going to come upon God's people during this time of judgment. But, you know, that doesn't really make any sense to me because of the detail. I think that the detail itself necessitates a literal understanding of this. If it was just, if 144,000 was just sort of a general number, just to talk about a lot of people being sealed, why go into the detail of breaking down each of the tribes name by name? It doesn't seem to me that that would be the right way to understand it. I think that we need to, as we have pointed out, take it at face value and understand that this is the beginning, as I said, of this new period in which God then turns his focus back upon the nation of Israel. Now, after these things, I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." All the angels stood around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures and fell on their faces before the throne and worshiped God, saying, "Amen." You know, amen is an interesting word. And most of the time when we translate it, it is a Hebrew word, actually, we say it means "so be it." And it does mean "so be it," but it means something more than that. It actually means more than "so be it." It means true. Remember when Jesus would say, "Verily, verily," or "truly, truly," it's the word "amen" that's being translated there. And so when that word is uttered, it's an affirmation that what has been said or what is about to be said is true. And so they said, "True, blessing and glory and wisdom, thanksgiving, honor, power, and might be to our God forever and ever. True." It is true. I like that understanding of the word. Then one of the elders. Now, remember, if we can think back to the scene there recorded in the fifth chapter, we have these elders. They're around the throne. And we saw that there are 24 elders. And it seems that they are a representative body, as we pointed out in the past, that they are actually representatives of the church. And so one of the elders answered, saying to me, "Who are these arrayed in white robes, and where did they come from?" And I said to him, "Sir, you know." So he said to me, "These are the ones who come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." Now, this is an entirely different group than we find in the fifth chapter. In the fifth chapter, we have there the song that's being sung, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and you have redeemed us to God by your blood out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation. And you have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth." Now, that is the church that's singing that song there. But now we have a different group. Now, it is also a great multitude, which no one can number, out of all the nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, but it is a distinct group from the church. You see, we do have some chronological order here. We've moved on from the events recorded in chapter 5, and now we are into the time of the sixth seal being opened. So to say that this group here is the same group as those in the fifth chapter, I think, is to fail to recognize that we've moved on from that point. But who are these? That's the question. That's the question the elder asked John, and John is puzzled. He says, "I don't know. You tell me." But the elder tells him, "These are the ones who have come out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." Now, remember back with the fifth seal? When he opened the fifth seal, "I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held." I believe that when it says these are those who came out of the great tribulation, these are those who have received Christ during that time of judgment on the earth, partially perhaps because of the witness of the 144,000, and partially because of the work of the Spirit during that time. I believe that the greatest harvest in all of history will probably transpire in the tribulation itself. That multitudes, and that's what we are reading about right here, multitudes from every tribe, tongue, and nation are going to come to Christ during this time of tribulation. When they see the evil that's let loose upon the world, when they see these cataclysmic events that are transpiring, when they see this man, this man who is the devil incarnate, come and take authority over all of the world, many in the world are going to turn to Christ at this point. There are some 1 billion Muslims in the world today. And we know mostly about the radical fundamentalist Muslims who are engaging in terrorism. But there are multitudes, and actually the majority of Muslims are not engaged in that kind of activity. They are just people, everyday, average people like everybody else. And some of them are devout and sincere in regard to their religion. And I would imagine that from that mass of people, there will be a huge ingathering during this period of time. Because after all, you could see that perhaps their eyes would be opened at that time, that they would come to understand that all of this that's going on, and then the word that's going out about Christ, that would turn many of their hearts. Perhaps many Hindus or Buddhists You know, we talk today in missionary circles about the 1040 window. The 1040 window is that part of the world where most of the population is found. China, India, Southeast Asia, the Middle East. We talk about that as being sort of the target in regard to missions, because that's where the majority of people are, and that's where the majority of people who've never heard the gospel are. And I think that from that region there will be these multitudes that are brought in. But it does seem that they will come by way of martyrdom, that they will be persecuted, and as we saw there under the fifth seal, that they will give up their lives for Christ during that time. Or perhaps they are just, many of them, because of all of the cataclysmic activity going on in the earth, many of them are perhaps dying because of these kinds of things. Just like Christians today die in catastrophes, they're not exempt to that. So these might also come in through that kind of a way. But they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb, and therefore they are before the throne of God, and they serve Him day and night in His temple. Now, see here, I think we have, again, a clear distinction between those in the fifth chapter and this group here. And they have an exclusive ministry now of serving God in His temple day and night. Now, the church, according to passages that we read earlier, the church is going to be ruling and reigning with Christ on the earth during the kingdom age. But this group is going to be serving God day and night in His temple. And I think it's clearly a reference to the temple in heaven rather than any temple here on earth. And He who sits on the throne will dwell among them, and they shall neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them, nor any heat. So notice that. It seems to me in verse 16 that these are the things that they were suffering while they were living here on the earth during the tribulation. They were suffering from hunger and from thirst and from exposure and that sort of thing. And we know that there's a point where the sun is going to be heated up, as we can read about in the 16th chapter. For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So John sees this other group in heaven now. And these are the ones that are coming out of the tribulation period. When he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. Then another angel, having a golden censer, came and stood at the altar. He was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of the saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayer of the saints ascended before God from the angel's hand. Then the angel took the censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. And there were noises, thunderings, lightnings, and an earthquake. So the seven angels who had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. Now, it's a hard thing for us to understand, but remember, John is seeing both worlds. John is, he's been transported in the spirit into the future to this day of the Lord. And the veil, if you will, has been pulled back, and John sees both worlds. Now, both worlds exist, but we can't see both of them. We only see the one world, the material world that we live in. But we know by experience that there's something else that's going on. There's something going on in the invisible realm. We know by experience, we know because the scriptures tell us that is the case, that we are in a conflict between the principalities and the powers. We know that nations and kingdoms and peoples are ruled by powerful spiritual forces. But you see, we know that by faith. We know that because of what the scriptures tell us and to some degree because of what we experience. But for John, everything has been opened up wide and he can see both worlds. He can see the activity of these angels and what they're doing with this censer and these prayers, all of this mixed together, and the censer being thrown to the earth. I don't think anybody on the earth is going to see the censer hit the earth when it hits the earth. It's happening in the spiritual realm, but they will indeed experience the result of that happening. So when we're reading through the book of Revelation, we have to understand that that's what's going on here. John is, he's telling us about both worlds, and he's describing the invisible world that's now become visible to him. He's describing it to us in the best terms that he can. So, the first angel sounded, and hail and fire followed, mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. So now we had first of all, you see, the judgment is coming in increments. We had first of all, in the seals, we had a fourth that was destroyed. So the population and the vegetation, these different things have been reduced by a quarter. Now what's remaining, the three-fourths, is going to be reduced by another third. So we read there in regard to the fourth seal that when death and Hades came forth, a fourth of the earth's population dies as a result of this. But now we move from the fourths down to the thirds. Then the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. So again, John sees the spiritual world colliding with the physical world. Then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. Now, the plagues in Egypt and the judgments that come upon the world, there's an interesting connection. Each of those things that God judged in Egypt were part of the hierarchy of deities that the Egyptians worshipped. So as God was bringing forth these judgments upon the Nile, turning the water into blood, you remember how we read about that in the story there in Exodus. And when he's bringing the frogs on the land and the lice and all of these different things, you see, each one of these things, God was exercising his authority over the deities of Egypt. These were all the things that the Egyptians worshipped. And God was showing his superiority over these things. You know, it's interesting. We are living in a time when there is a return in a major way to nature worship. You see, for a long time, under a Christian worldview, there was the understanding that nature was subject to man, and man was to subdue nature, not in an abusive way like it has happened. And it wasn't Christians who, you know, began the Industrial Revolution and put pollution into the air like secularists try to say. But it was a Christian worldview that gave man the understanding that the earth was here for our benefit. We're not to abuse it, but we're to utilize it. But you know, things have changed a lot over the past 30 to 40 years. And there's so much nature worship, and it's not just going on amongst New Age, you know, people that are, you find down at Mother's Kitchen or, you know, some of these other places where I shop. But it's all over the place. I mean, we've got crazy legislation protecting bugs and protecting all kinds of animals and varmints. And, you know, it's just absolutely nuts. But it's not anything less than an idolatry of nature. It is, what we're doing is we're going back. It's a neo-paganism. The pagans, of course, pagan means, it's a word that comes from the peasants, and it refers to the peasants' religion. The peasants worshipped nature. And that's what we see. We see a revival of the worship of nature going on in our culture today. And again, like I'm saying, it is being legislated. And so if you, you know, get too close to some birds and scare them away, they'll handcuff you and take you to jail. You disrupted their nest or something like that. It's insanity. It's craziness. God, in this tribulation period, is bringing a judgment upon all of the things that man worships. All of the things that man worships, excluding God. You know, the craziness of man, the insanity of man is here. You know, we live on this planet that God created, and every single thing we know and experience that is pleasant, pleasurable, enjoyable, helpful, whatever the case, it's all been given to us by God. But what happens with many, they stand up, shake their fist into the air and say, there is no God. I'm God. I just read a book yesterday. A great book. If you want some good reading, I recommend you pick up the book, What's So Great About Christianity? Dinesh D'Souza is the author. I don't agree with everything he says. A couple chapters, I strongly disagree with him on certain points. But generally speaking, it is a fantastic book, and it's a fantastic refutation of the atheism and the humanism and the worship of nature and all the things that are presently dominating our culture. It's a powerful refutation of these ideas. But one of the things you see when you listen to the spokesman for the new atheism, guys like Sam Harris or Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins, you listen to what they're saying. They have a great hostility toward God, and they speak as though the world belongs to them and it's ours, and we are scientists and philosophers, and they have this venom toward God. And then, you know, all of this speculation. I think it's the height of folly for a man who will live, let's say, we'll just stretch it out as far as you can go. Let's just say, I think a guy died recently. He was 117 years old. I think that's the record. So let's just say 120 years. I think it is the absolute height of folly for somebody who will live a maximum 120 years to sit around and pontificate about millions or billions of years. What kind of insanity is that? Or, you know, to sit here on this planet and say, this planet is nothing, just a little speck. Anybody could create a planet like this. It's poorly designed. Or to sit there in your body saying, this is nothing. This eye is a joke. It's very poorly designed. The lens is backward. If there's really a God, he's really not a very good designer. So I could, you know, when you listen to this stuff, you just think, man, if I were God, I would just... But, you know, people wonder, well, you know, I don't like this idea about God judging and, you know, people going to hell and all of this. You know what? Men and women, we are rebels. Man is a rebel against his creator. Man is a rebel who says, I don't care what you say, God, I'm going to do it my own way and I'm going to do my best to just try to pretend like you don't exist. An interesting thing that this guy drew as a conclusion, which I already had known, but it was interesting to see somebody put it in print. He said the driving force behind the new atheism is nothing more or nothing less than sexual desire. And he's absolutely right. Man does not want there to be a God to tell him he can't sleep with this person, that person, or the other person. And the greatest spokesmen for atheism have themselves pretty much said that. But this judgment, God once again, like he did in Egypt. Now, Egypt was just a picture. The judgment on Pharaoh in Egypt was a picture, a small scale version of the judgment that will come ultimately upon the entire planet and all of the gods that men have worshipped in substitute of the true and the living God. And that is what we are reading about here. And so, what are men worshipping? They're worshipping the creatures in the sea. I mentioned to you a few weeks ago when I was in South Africa, the proliferation of great white sharks because they're sacred now. You can't kill them. And if they eat you, well, the New Ager just says, well, you know, you were in their turf. Too bad. You shouldn't go in the water. You shouldn't go in the ocean. That's their home, not yours. And these kinds of things. But we see it worshiping these mammals. You know, you've probably been to SeaWorld, and I like, you know, the entertainment there is fine, and, you know, seeing the killer whales and the dolphins and all of that, but it gets a little bit weird when they start talking about this mystical union, you know, between us and these creatures. And of course, now the attitude and the mentality is that, you know, at one time the world was perceived to be, the earth was perceived to be at the center of the universe. And that was not a biblical idea. It was a Greek idea. Aristotle and Ptolemy had that idea. And for centuries, that was the view. And then Copernicus came along and started to sort of, you know, shake that view up a little bit. And then Galileo came on later and brought some new information. Then eventually the view changed to the heliocentric view. Heliocentric meaning the sun is at the center, not the earth at the center. And that because the earth was no longer perceived to be at the center of things, certain people took that not just scientifically in regard to the heavenly bodies, but certain people took it and said, well, if the earth's not at the center of the universe, like we've been told, then man must not be as significant as we once thought he was. And then with the introduction of Darwinism and all of that, and the idea that everything is all connected, everything just evolved, the whole point was to throw man out of the center as being created in the image of God. And when man is thrown out of the center as being created in the image of God, then man is no more of no more value than any other creature. And so we live in a culture where people have great compassion for baby seals who are being bashed over the head for their furs. but couldn't care less about baby human beings being sucked out of the wombs of women through abortion. You see, because what's the difference between a seal and a person? In the minds of these people, there is no difference. There's no difference whatsoever. This is the world we're living in. And God is going to bring His judgment upon the living creatures, upon the rivers of water, all of these things that men worship. Then the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun was struck, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so that a third of them were darkened. A third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. And I looked and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. So we are right here in the thick of this judgment that's coming. And then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star, notice, fallen, past tense, from heaven to the earth. And now listen to him. So John previously saw a star that struck the waters, but now he uses the same terminology, but he's speaking of not an inanimate object, he's speaking of a person as a star. He's speaking of the devil. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Think about this. Now, listen. The book of Revelation is not entirely symbolic. It uses plenty of symbolic language, but it uses symbolic language to describe literal events. And what we're reading about here, here's the symbolic part of it. I saw a star falling from heaven. But the star is actually a reference to Satan himself. There is a bottomless pit that's going to be opened up. Strange thought that somewhere here on the earth, there is a pit. No one knows where it is. No person knows where it is, obviously. But God knows where it is. And in that pit, there are demonic beings that are incarcerated. This is weird stuff. But it's real stuff. Isn't it interesting? You probably don't go to a lot of movies. I don't either. But you know, it's like more and more the movies that are coming out, they're all incorporating all of this supernatural stuff. Do you notice that? It's rare today to see just a good old-fashioned cowboy movie or something like that, you know, or just a good old-fashioned love story. It's got all of this weird stuff that's connected to it. All of this spiritual stuff, all of this weird, now they wouldn't call it demonic necessarily, some in some cases they would, but it's this interaction with the spirit world, and this is what's being portrayed to us over and over all the time. And this is happening on the level of major motion pictures, it's happening on the level of cartoons, and you know, so many of the cartoons that kids are watching now, you've got an avatar, you've got a spirit guide, you've got all of this kind of stuff going on, the video games, all of that. There's a huge interconnection that's occurring in our culture with the spirit world. Anybody who thinks there's no spirit world has got their head in the sand. Where does all this stuff come from? It surely isn't simply the imagination of men. But this bottomless pit, smoke arises out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So who are they commanded to harm? They're commanded to harm every living person except the 144,000. That tells me that the church cannot possibly be here in the world at this time, because God has made it clear to us He has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation. And if we were here, we would be amongst that number, because we are not the descendants of Jacob. We would be amongst that number that would be tormented by these. This is one of the reasons why it's hard to imagine anyone believing that the church will be here during this time. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. Now, I've never been stung by a scorpion, but I've heard it is extremely painful. A bee is bad enough, in my opinion, but a scorpion is far worse. In those days, listen to this, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. This is a time when God is going to punish the world for its evil. Now, the smug atheist says, well, I don't believe in a God who'd do something like that. Well, too bad. He's going to do it anyway, whether you believe it or not. It's as simple as that. You know, you can sit and philosophize all day long. God is going to judge the world. He created the world. He created people for a specific reason and to do a specific thing. And when they consistently rebel against Him, He punishes them. And He's going to punish the world for its evil. And you can disagree with that, not like that, say there is no God. You can do that all day long. It doesn't change anything. It is what it is. The shape of the locust was like horses prepared for battle. Now, listen, John is not describing here a tank or an armored vehicle or, some sort of a modern weapon that he didn't have any way of really, understanding in his day. So he's just doing his best and trying to describe it. These are demonic entities. These are creatures that he's describing that have been released out of the bottomless pit. They are locust. But listen to the description. Their shape was like horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold. Now, crown, not meaning they actually had a crown, but on the head itself. Something that looked like a golden crown. Their faces were like the faces of men, and they had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. Watch some of the fantasy stuff, Lord of the Rings, some of that stuff, even go back to Star Wars, they got some really funky creatures. Well, probably some similarity. But think about that. It's got the face like the face of a man. Sometimes you look under a microscope at a certain kind of a bug or something, and all of a sudden you're like, well, that looks like a person. Remember when I was a kid seeing this movie called The Fly, and it ended up with this guy's head, and help me, help me. It was in the spider's web. That used to freak me out when I was little. Some of you saw that. I don't think that's even anywhere. It's probably completely destroyed. But they had breastplates like the breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. Man, imagine that. Have you ever been anywhere near a swarm of bees? You get around a swarm of bees, and man, it is... You hear it. It's, this great hum. But imagine this. It's like, it's going to sound like, it will sound probably like helicopters or bombers or something like that. But that's not what he's describing. He's describing creatures that are let out of the bottomless pit. And they had a king, or they had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months, and they had a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. Both of those words mean destroyer. And so they have a king over them. One woe is past. Behold, still two more woes are coming after these things. Wow. One woe is past. Now, here's the thing. We're going to stop right there. We've run out of time, and we'll pick up in verse 13 next week. But here's the thing. We are reading an account of the future. These are future events that will take place just as surely as Jesus came into the world, died, rose again, and ascended into heaven. He's going to come back to the world, and these are the things that will accompany his coming. These are the things that will precede his coming. Now, we don't know when the Lord's coming back, obviously, but we do know that all of the signs in the world today indicate that the time is getting close. We've got all of the signs. The great sign of the Jewish people restored to their homeland after 2,000 years of dispersion. And that, of course, is a fulfillment of prophecy. That's what the Bible said would happen. We've got the sign of this whole thing coming together in Europe. This new national entity, the European Union, that is the greatest economic power in the world right now. And it's going to keep advancing. Things are going to keep moving in a positive direction for that entity. Because it's going to be the base from which all of these things are going to happen. We've got the technology. So many things that we'll continue to read about here. Decades ago, of course, centuries ago, people scratch their head and say, boy, it's hard to understand how this could happen. We've got the technology for all of it today. So, you know, anybody who's sitting around betting that this is all just a coincidence and it doesn't really mean anything, and, you know, those people who say Jesus is coming soon, they don't know what they're talking about, I think that person is deluded. And, you know, it's not any time to be messing around. It's not any time to be dilly-dallying around with the world. It's just not the time to do it. And so don't be doing that. Give yourself to the Lord. Live for Him. Follow Him. Serve Him. Because the last thing you ever want to do is miss that trumpet call when the rapture occurs, and be left here in the world to face these things that are going to come upon the earth. Jesus said in Luke 22, he said, pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape these things. We want to escape these things. Some people say, oh, that rapture teaching, that's an escapist mentality. You're darn right it is. And I want to escape these things. And any thinking person wants to escape them too.